Dr. J. Michelson is an author, an activist, and a prolific commentator on goings-on at the highest court in the land, where this month cases were heard that may well give one strain of Christianity dominance over all Americans like we haven't seen in over a century. We've seen nothing less than a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade, as well as to the separation of public funding and religious education in the past 2 weeks. And I'm grateful, very grateful, to have Jay with us again to address the ramifications. I always learn from him. We always learn from him. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. It's always good to be here.
You were with us not long ago to foreshadow how this conservative high court would likely handle the Dobbs v. Jackson case. What caught your attention about the arguments that we heard December 1st?
Well, right. This is our I Told You So episode. When the Texas restrictions on abortion came up, and we were, you know, justifiably concerned about that, I said, you know, never mind Texas. The real thing is Mississippi, and this is a frontal challenge to Roe versus Wade that I think the court will take. I told you so. Unfortunately, we told your listeners.
Yes.
So I think a lot of folks were surprised by how direct the openness was in the oral argument toward overturning Roe versus Wade. Some of the language coming from Justice Barrett was a little surprising, that, you know, we tolerate incursions on bodily autonomy all the time, as if a vaccine mandate to save life, you know, was the same as forced pregnancy and forcing women to give birth. That was pretty shocking and kind of went unchallenged. You know, it's not really the place of Supreme Court advocates to challenge a justice on some statement like that, but it was certainly a shocking statement. So I think the overtness that the court seemed, or the court's conservatives seemed to display, to go for broke, you know, not do a sort of Justice Roberts compromise where maybe 15 weeks is okay, but to have an abortion ban, but not, you know, totally overturn Roe v. Wade. That did not seem like a popular position. And it seems almost certain that the core of Roe will be overturned in the springtime.
A new poll shows 40% of respondents now believe this case will lead to the reversal of Roe v. Wade. At the same time, we know a large majority of Americans support some degree of reproductive freedom. So how can we reconcile that? Shouldn't we be seeing more public concern and protest, even if it's mostly symbolic?
Well, it is, though, mostly symbolic. The ship has sailed, right? I mean, the three Trump appointees to the Supreme Court, all handpicked by the Federalist Society, and with a very, not just a religious bias, but a very arch conservative religious fundamentalist bias, guiding those three picks. That's totally transformed the court. That's done. So I'm not sure that, you know, hitting the streets now is necessarily going to do anything. I do think, you know, if you look in terms of politics, there's a silver lining. I don't want to say that there's a silver lining to stripping, you know, all women in America of rights to their own bodily autonomy. But in terms of politics, this could help the Democrats if this happens as expected in May or June. You know, that's going to be just in time for the 2022 elections. Justice Breyer may or may not retire around that time. So the court will be front and center. And as you noted, public opinion is very different from where the Supreme Court is on this. Mm-hmm. You should definitely expect that dark red states will immediately ban all abortion, certainly Texas and Mississippi, Alabama, and probably several others. So it'll be a very live, real issue. It won't be something hypothetical or some threat in the future. The landscape will change probably as soon as May or June.
26 states are poised to ban abortion if Roe is struck down. California has signaled a willingness to become an abortion refuge state. How on earth did we get here?
Yeah, we got here through a lot of complacency on the left, honestly, about some of these judicial picks. You know, you and I have been talking about this for a decade now, and sometimes it's whistling in the wind. Obviously, there's a lot of other issues to be concerned about. Even before the pandemic, even before Trump, there, you know, even before climate change became as real as it is in our daily lives, there are a lot of things to be concerned about. But there is a sense that the right took the judiciary much more seriously than the left. They had a concerted effort. There's no left-wing equivalent of the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network. There are good organizations doing really good work, obviously. But in terms of the sort of master plan, in terms of the amount of money and amount of resources, the left was just outgunned on this. And we got to this place because, you know, we've tolerated this to happen. We tolerated, you know, the left sort of went along with Justice Gorsuch's nomination, which was illegitimate. The left, or at least the center, Susan Collins, swore to us that Brett Kavanaugh would not vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, which obviously he is soon to do. Well, I shouldn't say obviously, but likely he's soon to do. And, you know, we've even gone sort of along with the legitimacy of Justice Barrett. And the worst of it, in my opinion, is that this complacency is continuing even now. So there is a commission under President Biden to look at reform of the Supreme Court, and they've released the final draft of that report, and it's toothless. It says nothing. It's like, well, there are a lot of views people feel strongly about the Supreme Court. That is absolutely unacceptable from my perspective, whether it's adding justices to the court to compensate for the abuses of the previous 4 years, or whether it's adding term limits, which is something that I've gone on record as supporting, that would be effective immediately for Supreme Court justices. Something has to be done, not issuing some report that, you know, says that there are a lot of options on the table. Again, maybe there's a silver lining that when this is real in May or June, maybe there will be enough, you know, enough pressure and enough momentum to make some real changes to restore the legitimacy of the court, because everybody knows that the jig is up, that this is just a political arm of the Republican Party at this point. And it pains me to say that. You know, I've been a lawyer for you know, 25 years, and this is not the Supreme Court that I grew up with.
Yeah. In a poignantly personal Huffington Post op-ed, Interfaith Alliance Policy Director Katie Joseph emphasized that Jewish teachings, to take just one example, say life starts at birth, and therefore protecting the life of an expectant mother is paramount throughout the 9 months of pregnancy. So the language being used to assault Roe is not just anti-science, but explicitly violates the deeply held religious beliefs of many Americans. As a rabbi, can you speak to this unconstitutional dead end we find ourselves in?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Maybe the right will support religious exemptions to these abortion bans, right? So there are a lot of religious exemptions for religious conservatives, for folks who have a religious objection to a law. So whether that might be about women or LGBTs or any other issue, so there should be an exemption to every abortion ban, saying that if you have a religious teaching that says that it's required to save the life of a mother, then of course you should have a religious exemption to that abortion ban. Something inside tells me that's not going to happen, but that would be at the very least fair to have an equal religious exemption when a law punishes those who have a different religious belief than the majority.
We have an entire separate crisis in the making with a case the Supremes heard this past Wednesday. What do we need to know about that?
This was another case about public funding of religious schools. Maine has a very unusual program. It's not a school voucher program, but it's a program for people in rural areas to access education where there are no public schools. And that's only Maine and Vermont have that kind of a program. They pay for any private school education, but not religious school. And based on the oral arguments, which I listened to yesterday, it seems certain the court is going to strike that down as unconstitutional because it discriminates against religious parents and religious schools. You know, the issue, though, is that if Maine were to fund religious, if Maine will fund religious schools, these aren't just schools which happen to be affiliated with a religious order. These are schools which have a religious mission, as well they should. Religious schools are great. There's nothing wrong with religious schools. There's only something wrong with public funding of religious school. And these schools aren't trying to sneak around or to conform with the law and say we're secular, really. They're proudly religious institutions. They don't just have mandatory chapel service. They don't just have Bible classes. They also, all of the subjects that they teach are from a religious point of view. So whether that's evolution or any other subject, which there might be some religious conservative teaching about it, that's how they present it. And that's going to be required to be publicly funded. You know, to me, and this is kind of a long answer, but I think the bigger question that these cases bring up is this word discrimination. So in New York Magazine yesterday, I wrote out an article about that the claim that not getting some sort of benefit and extending a benefit, right? Maine's benefit is secular education for all. But to say, no, actually, I'm also entitled to this other thing, to say not getting that is discrimination, that's not what we usually mean by discrimination. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see that same argument come up in a number of COVID cases, vaccine mandate cases that are coming through. So where I live in New York, there's now a vaccine mandate for religious school teachers as well as for public school teachers. That's certain to be challenged. And you know, if you think about it, what's being argued or asked for by the religious right is the right to kill other people, right? I have a religious belief that suppose I have some religious belief that, you know, makes vaccines not okay. Interestingly, by the way, a poll was released today by PRRI that it's about 10% of Americans. So it's not all evangelicals. It's not all religious conservatives. It's about 1/10 of Americans believe that getting a vaccine would violate their religious tenets. So 1 in 10. Anyway, so if I'm in that 1 in 10, I should be able to go into a crowded restaurant or a crowded theater, even if there's a vaccine mandate, and expose other people to this virus because I have a religious belief. And this now it starts to look a lot like this inversion of religious freedom that you and I've talked about again for 10 years.
Yeah.
That because I have a religious belief or faith or practice, that I can take away someone else's right to, whether it's to equality or to access healthcare or now even to live. That no state can stop me from, you know, from breaking a public health law. That is what's coming up. And so this is not just something, this case in Maine isn't something that just affects these kids in rural Maine. The principle that this is discrimination affects all of us.
Did you know this was coming on top of where we already were in such turmoil? How did this one get to the SCOTUS level?
Well, it's, you know, there was a case last year about school voucher programs, and that was arguably kind of a bigger case because there are a number of states with school voucher programs. They're much larger than this kind of idiosyncratic Maine program. But this is different in key respects. And so this is expanding that previous case. But, you know, all eyes for the court are focused on abortion and some also on the gun case, which is also a major constitutional case this term. And, this one, it was picked up by good folks, you know, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. There were other organizations who were paying attention to this and a couple of op-eds. And I think the ACLU was paying attention. But, you know, the abortion cases may be different from most of these cases because it's so high profile. A lot of what's happened in the court and religion has been little bit by bit chipping it away, a lot of it on what's called the shadow docket. So all of those COVID pandemic cases were in what's called the shadow docket because they're not officially on the docket. They're cases that the court takes on some sort of emergency basis. There's a lot less transparency, a lot less accountability. And we saw a huge shift from when Justice Ginsburg was on the court to when Justice Barrett replaced her. You know, 180 degree inversion to now basically exempt churches and religious organizations from any public health law, which to my mind is crazy. I don't think it's discrimination to hold churches to appropriate public health standards. I think that's a standard equal treatment. So we're moving to a place now where what sort of legal scholars call most favored nation for religious claims, where those claims trump any other claim that anyone else might make. And it will be interesting in the abortion case to see if that is also true when it's a progressive or religious progressive making that case, right? Mm-hmm. Religious progressives are religious too. We're not fake. We're real. And now that there are laws that contradict my religious views, I should be able to get the same exemptions that religious conservatives or self-styled religious conservatives get. Again, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
You wrote about the Carson case in New York Magazine, and the headline pulls no punches. The Supreme Court is ready to make taxpayers fund religious schools. Do most people in the United States understand how important this is and what a change it's going to bring about?
No, not at all. Yeah. This is not, you know, this is sort of, you know, there are a lot of school and religion cases, and I'm sure that, you know, the public understanding of this is in the single digits at most. Yeah. But again, that you see a difference between left and right. On the right, these issues are taken very seriously. Right. And I would suspect among, again, a sort of, you know, self-styled religious conservatives, you know, probably a large percentage were following this case, are aware of it. They probably received a lot of fundraising email about it, and they've put it as a priority because they understand that, you know, that this is how this kind of culture war can be fought and won. And just if you reflect on the sort of anti-democratic nature of this, this isn't all religious people who want taxpayer funding of religious schools. This is a small segment of religious people. What, you know, we're thinking maybe 20, 25% of the population at most. And yet, because of the capture of the Supreme Court, that's the law of the land. And this is going to affect much more than just Maine's little program, mm-hmm. right? This will affect any kind of taxpayer, any kind of school choice program, any kind of subsidy program. And to say that you have to fund a religious activity, and not just, again, like, you know, there's another case a few years ago about does a program have to be available to fund the sort of athletic facilities of a religious school? And the court said yes, because this is just a, you know, this is not a religious activity that's being funded, and they should be treated on the same equal footing. But this is totally different. This is, must taxpayer funding be used to fund, you know, mandatory chapel and mandatory Bible instruction, yeah. and all of the things which religious schools do and do very well. And so that, but no, I would say certainly on the leftmost 75% of the country, no one is paying attention to that.
You know, we're facing a situation here where some taxpayers would be forced to fund education, just as we've talked about, that actively condemns and marginalizes them. Take LGBTQI+ taxpayers as an example. How does that play out?
Two of the schools at issue in the Maine case don't take LGBTQ students and won't employ LGBTQ people as teachers. Again, from a private school perspective, that may be appropriate, certainly on the teacher side, if, you know, they have a particular reading of scripture, and this is, you know, and then people can make the choice whether or not they want to support that. But I don't have, if I'm a Maine taxpayer, I don't have a choice. My taxpayer money is supporting that school, and is not only supporting that school, but is paying for students to go and learn in that environment that's marginalizing me. So, you know, certainly from a taxpayer point of view, that's really troubling. But one of the schools actually has in their curriculum that part of the purpose of their Bible of their, it was in a social studies class, actually, the purpose of the social studies class was to help Christian students fight Islam and defeat the false teachings of the Islamic faith. I think I've got that wording right. Now imagine you're a Muslim taxpayer in Maine and your taxpayer money is going to fight Islam. I mean, that, first of all, you know, that's a pretty offensive thing, even if it's just a private school. But the idea that it's required by the Constitution for taxpayers to fund a school that says we're equipping students to fight the false teachings of the Islamic religion, you know, that is a brave new world that we're living in.
Let me just quickly ask you, the Biden Supreme Court Commission just released its report. Did you see that as good or bad? And do you expect anything come from that?
I am pretty outraged by the mealy-mouthed nature of that report. I suppose on the upside, it kind of lets the president and the Democrats kind of do whatever they want. You know, unfortunately, yet again, this is going to come down to the handful of moderates in the Senate as to whether they want to actually do anything. And it's hard for me to imagine those moderate Democrats going along with a serious plan to reform the Supreme Court. They may even need to suspend the filibuster in order to do it, which makes it doubly unlikely. But I think this commission has wasted a great opportunity, which was to come out behind a particular proposal that remedied in a direct way both the immediate problems of the last few years under Trump, but also of the system itself, right? So life tenure for judges, justices was announced when life expectancy was a lot less than it was now. No one expected people to, you know, there were a couple of exceptions actually on the early Supreme Court, but in the main, there wasn't an expectation that every justice was going to serve on this court for 40 years. So the stakes are just much too high. Right. And it's effectively random when it happens. Right. So because the late Justice Ginsburg died when she did and not 3 months later, you know, now there's no abortion in America. You know, the stakes are much too high for this kind of this process. If we had term limits, if we had sort of a simple way, each justice, and then those were regularized. So it wouldn't even have to be the same number of years, but you knew when the next confirmation battle was going to come. So you couldn't play around with it and play the games that Republicans played in the last few years. You know, this commission was a broad commission of a lot of experts, and I understand it's hard to get agreement, but the reality is they're coming out with nothing. And so that does not strengthen the hand of anyone trying to say, let's go forward, because they can't say we're going to implement what this smart commission said. You know, that's one of the reasons you have smart commissions. So to say it's disappointing is an understatement.
Jay, I very seldom ever do this. I don't know whether I have ever done it, but I'm going to today. You've mentioned several times that we've been talking about this stuff for 10 years at least. Now we're looking at a huge – you're kind of a pastor to me. I've read you. I've listened to you. I've watched what you do other places. What should we be feeling? How do we deal with this?
No, I appreciate that, and I appreciate those words. I think you know, for me as a man, I think a lot of the work is on really inhabiting what it would feel like to live in a country that doesn't respect my own humanity and agency. I think, you know, we're two men having this conversation. So I think it's me listening to the voices of women. I think we'll hear a lot more of those voices when this ruling actually comes out. I think now, in a certain way, we're in a kind of waiting period now. You know, we don't know for certain what's going to happen from the Supreme Court. You know, when we do, when that's happened, and when some of those 26 states pass their laws, I think there'll be a great outcry. And hope, you know, again, as a man, I hope I can lend my voice to that and support the voices of women who hopefully will be leading it. And I do think, again, I don't want to really use the language silver lining, because these are people's lives that are at stake. And even if it's, you know, temporary, or it's only in some states or whatever, that, you know, this kind of moral outrage is real. I do think that there's an opportunity for some kind of redemption. You know, we just mentioned that this has been kind of a stealth attack for a long time. It won't be that when this case comes out. It will be, you know, not just headline news, but front and center for folks. I think there'll be, for people who aren't as engaged as you or I, there'll be more of an understanding that this is real. And, you know, we'll hear more stories of women in yeah. you know, tragic situations who were being manipulated by a system that doesn't take their rights into adequate account. So I think there is, I think for me, on a sort of more pastoral, spiritual level, it's preparing for that and preparing to be supportive and understanding that there is redemption here, that I think that the court is so out of step, as you've mentioned, with the large majority of Americans, including people who are personally anti-abortion, but who are, you know, pro-choice because mm-hmm. they don't think that their beliefs should dictate the actions of others. Yeah. And that's a lot of people in the population. So the court is so out of step with that. And these legislators are so out of step with it. We might get actually a real questioning of why are these legislatures so out of step? Well, mm-hmm. because of gerrymandering, because the system is rigged, because of the destruction of the Voting Rights Act, because of systematic disenfranchisement of voters of color. Mm-hmm. So those are all things which we can fight. And which there are great organizations on the ground doing, you know, let's re-register all of those people who were pulled out of the polls. There's a great organization called Students for Justice, which is paying students to do this individually. You know, they can purge 10,000 voters at a time. We have to go back and reach each one of them individually and get them back on the polls and tell them what's happened to them and tell them that there are people taking away their rights to vote. Because if everybody voted representative of America, the legislatures wouldn't look like they do. Mm-hmm. They would actually look representative. Yeah. And then we could have non-gerrymandered districts. And then we could have something that looks a little more like democracy. So I think it's focusing on those opportunities for redemption. It's good to look backward, as we've done, and see how did we get here. And also, accommodating to this new reality, it's thinking about what we can do to fix it.
Thank you. Rabbi Dr. Jay Michelson is a columnist for New York Magazine and a meditation teacher and podcast host at 10% Happier. He has written about the Supreme Court for the last 8 years, first for the Daily Beast and now for New York, and before that worked as a religious LGBTQ activist for 10 years. Jay is the author of numerous books, most recently Enlightenment by Trial and Error. Jay, as always, thank you for sharing your insights with us on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work.